I'd like to read from this letter that's going to go out to all friends, dated February 15th, 2003. It's a follow-up of what I read before. Dear friends, it was over a month ago I wrote to you about some experiences I was having. You responded with such love and prayers, and I truly felt the power of all that support. Thank you for giving to me in such a wonderful way. The experiences continued after writing you through the month of January. It has been quite a time. With the end of the month came the anniversary activities of Mother's Mahasamadhi. Approaching that time, I was not sure how much I would be able to participate in the planned events. When the time came, I was able to take part in everything, even as earlier in the month I was able to carry on the core values and planning class in Seattle when the time came for that. With the conclusion of those anniversary events, I felt as if a great weight had passed from me, as if a great work had been completed. Since that time, I have been in a state of recovery. Physical health is returning. Inner springs of energy and lightness are coming back. Although I continue to feel the tensions of the world in this body, it is not as continuous as before. What can we, as devotees, do to help in times like this of great world tension? The greatest thing is to keep our minds on God, on the great light of being. When we are attuned to that divine vibration, it raises our consciousness to the source of all that is good, beautiful, and uplifting. We may be keenly aware of world events, but let us be more aware of the divine presence. This awareness of God acts as a healing balm upon the wounds of the world. Peace is of the greatest importance, and it begins within. The inner peace then spreads to our families, friends, work sites, and out to our communities. Let us tend to our daily lives in ways that support the peaceful coexistence of all. Let that peace extend in the form of prayer and positive thought towards world leaders and countries around the world. Let your vision rise above differences and see the golden light of spirit permeating all in all. People of good intentions and conscience can disagree on what should be done in any situation. There are people who think the worst of those that disagree with their point of view. A mark of a mature soul is a knowledge of human character. Surely we can see beyond differences of opinion and perceive the sincerity of the individual. Do not lose sight of the divine within all, even when you vehemently disagree with some. By seeing God within those with whom you have differences, you will bring out the best in everyone, including yourself. When you lose this perspective and give in to fear, anger, and hatred, you lose more than your balance. You lose connection with your soul. There are many events unfolding currently that will have telling effects on the world's future. As individual forms of the one life, each of us is called upon to participate in these world events. One of the greatest things we can do is to prayerfully attune our mind to the purity of God. To the human mind, it may seem a small thing to do. That is because the human mind does not fully perceive the power invoked in prayer. To really prayerfully attune your mind means to connect with that innate purity within you. Not many days ago, as I sat in quiet absorption, I had a tremendous experience. I felt myself in the stillness of being, beyond all the restless tides of creation. This timeless awareness is the root of consciousness, mine and yours. It was after this experience I wrote this. God the Father resides in the deep of being. There, stillness is vast. Conscious awareness is awake, expanded. All potential keeps like a pregnant womb. The direct perception of the sublime state sets the soul free. It acts as a foundation of unshakable knowledge. The intimacy of such experiences is such that one feels there's a complete unity of mind. I know when entering this world of duality, opinions vary. People of goodwill differ in their thoughts. I also know the reality of this deeper experience, where there is an underlying unity beyond the outer, bewildering diversity. This deeper reality is more powerful and truer than the outer differences. You are a child of God. You are indeed one with the infinite source from which all has sprung. In my heart and soul, I wish for you to know the purity and unity of that which I speak. I feel as if you are my very own, and want for you the experience of divine love and intimacy that I now feel. May you be ever blessed to know that presence. And reading from Paramahansa Yogananda and his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, under the first chapter, expanded commentary, The Battle of Life. From the moment of conception to the surrender of the last breath, man has to fight in each incarnation innumerable battles, biological, hereditary, bacteriological, physiological, climatic, social, ethical, political, sociological, psychological, metaphysical, so many varieties of inner and outer conflicts. Competing for victory in every encounter are the forces of good and evil. The whole intent of the Gita is to align man's efforts on the side of Dharma, or righteousness. The ultimate aim is self-realization, the realization of man's true self, the soul, as made in the image of God, one with the ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss of spirit. The first contest of the soul in each incarnation is with other souls seeking rebirth. With the union of the sperm and the ovum, to begin the formation of the new human body, a flash of light appears in the astral world, the heavenly homes of souls between incarnations. That light transmits a pattern which attracts a soul according to that soul's karma. The self-created influences from past actions, from actions of past lives. In each incarnation, karma works itself out partly through hereditary forces. The soul of a child is attracted into a family in which heredity is in conformance with the child's past karma. Many souls vie to enter this new cell of life. Only one will be victorious. In the case of multiple conception, more than one primal cell is present. Within the mother's body, the unborn child struggles against disease, darkness, and periodic feelings of limitation and frustration, as the soul consciousness in the unborn child remembers and then gradually forgets its greater freedom of expression during its astral sojourn. The soul within the embryo has to contend with karma, which is influencing for good or ill the formation of the body in which it is now a resident. Additionally, it encounters the vibratory influences that reach it from the outside, the environment and actions of the mother, external sounds and sensations, vibrations of love and hate, peace and anger. After birth, the struggles of the infant are between its instincts to seek comfort and survival and the opposing relative helplessness of its immature bodily instrument. A child begins his first conscious struggle when he has to choose between his desires to play aimlessly and his desire to learn, study, and pursue some course of systematic training. Gradually, more serious battles arise, forced upon it by karmic instincts from within, or by bad company environment from without. The youth finds himself confronted suddenly with a host of problems that often he has been ill-prepared to meet. Temptations of sex, greed, prevarication, money-making by easy but questionable means, pressure from the company he keeps, and social influences. The youth usually discovers he possesses no sword of wisdom with which to fight the invading armies of worldly experiences. The adult who lives without cultivating and employing his innate powers of wisdom and spiritual discrimination finds inexorably that the kingdom of his body and mind is being overrun by the insurgents of misery-making, wrong desires, destructive habits, failure, ignorance, disease, and unhappiness. Few men are even aware that a state of constant warfare exists in their kingdom. Usually, it is only when the devastation is nearly complete that men helplessly realize the sad ruin of their lives. The psychological conflict of health, prosperity, self-control, and wisdom has to be started anew each day in order for man to advance towards victory, reclaiming inch by inch the territories of the soul occupied by the rebels of ignorance. The yogi, the awakening man, is confronted not only with the external battles fought by all men, but also the internal clash between the negative forces of restlessness arising from manas, or the sense consciousness, and the positive power of his desire and effort to meditate, supported by buddhi, intelligence. When he tries to reestablish himself in the soul's inner spiritual kingdom, the subtle centers of life and divine consciousness in the spine and brain. The Gita, therefore, points out in its very first stanza the prime necessity of nightly introspection, that he may clearly discern which force, the good or the evil, has won the daily battle. To live in harmony with God's plan, man must ask himself each night the very pertinent question, gathered together on the sacred bodily tract, the field of good and evil actions, what did my opposing tendencies do? Which side won today in the ceaseless struggle? The crooked, tempting, evil tendencies and the opposing forces of self-discipline and discrimination? Come now, tell me, what did they do? The yogi, after each practice of concentrated meditation, asks his power of introspection, assembled in the region of consciousness, in the cerebral spinal axis, and on the field of body sensory activity, eager for battle, the mental sense faculties that try to pull the consciousness outward, and the children of soul's discriminative tendencies that seek to reclaim the inner kingdom. What did they? Who won this day? The ordinary individual like a skirmish-scarred, beleaguered warrior, is all too conversant with the battles. But often his haphazard training has been wanting in an understanding of the battlefield and of the science behind the attacks of the opposing forces. That knowledge would increase his victories and lessen the bewildering defeats. In the historical telling of the cause of the war of Kurukshetra, the noble sons of Pandu reign virtuously over their kingdom, until King Duryodhana, the wicked reigning son of the blind king, Dhritarashtra, cleverly took away the Pandavas, their kingdom, and banished them to exile. Symbolically, the kingdom of body and mind rightfully belongs to the king's soul and his noble subjects of virtuous tendencies. But King Ego and his kinsmen of wicked and noble tendencies cunningly usurp the throne. When king's soul arises to reclaim his territory, the body and mind become the battleground. How king's soul rules over his bodily kingdom, loses and then regains it, is the essence of the Gita. As Master here points out so succinctly, this battle and bodily consciousness and the divine consciousness within us, that battleground, is occurring every single day. The collective consciousness of man creates the world events which we see. Each one of us is a participant in that battle. Each one of us adds to the collective consciousness that has created everything. That is not to say that each one of us personally has total responsibility for everything that happens, but we are participant in all the world events nevertheless. We are here for a reason, for a purpose. It is not a haphazard reason or purpose for which we have come. It is not, as I sometimes thought when I was growing up in this world, in this family, that I somehow made a mistake, a wrong turn in the direction of my soul that ended me up in this world. Many of us have very conscious recollections of the astral worlds from which we have come, or the causal worlds, or the pure spirit of God. And if they are not absolutely conscious in us, they are very close to the consciousness, residing just under in the subconscious mind, reminding us of a different kind of life. Sri Yukteswar informs us that in the astral realms, each soul is assigned to an astral world, and that astral world corresponds to the vibration of the individual. Therefore, all the inhabitants of that world are roughly of the same kind of spirit, the same kind of mind, the same kind of soul experience. Life there, we are told, is much easier. It has an ease about it. It has a beauty about it. And yet, because of our innate desire nature that we carry around within us, we are drawn to this material world. Now, as we know, this material world is made up of good and bad. The relativities here are more striking than in the astral, and certainly more striking than the subtle causal. It is here that the battleground takes on its most terrific aspect. the body becomes a crucible. Now, crucible has a dual meaning. One meaning of it is the cross that Jesus was hung upon and becomes his crucible. Another meaning is the container in which different materials or metals are put together and are heated and become merged into an alloy, a combination of metals that are stronger than its original. When we construct this spiritual path properly, and that happens most powerfully and most efficiently in the guru-disciple relationship, that spiritual path becomes a container. The reason that Mother and other masters oftentimes emphasize loyalty and sticking to a particular spiritual path once you've entered on it is because that is the crucible, that is the container that becomes the place where the alchemy of the transformation of the soul from the human to the divine can occur in the best and the most efficient way. Those who do not construct that crucible, that container, and keep it whole, find that all the contents that have been working on the inside are lost through the holes and the cracks that are created within the crucible. Those who enter a spiritual path and discipline for a period of time and then leave that behind lose all of the spiritual living waters that were being gathered in that container. Those that continue with their discipline, continue with their spiritual path once they find it, find that the tensions within themselves continue to build. The strain upon the crucible, the container, continues to be tremendous. The more we progress on this path, the greater become the strains upon the container. That is why oftentimes that spiritual disciples and aspirants who are traveling upon the path feel as if their life has become more intense, more difficult. And it is true. It has. They are living in a more conscious way. They are evolving in a more conscious way. And as a result of that, they receive more and more of these pressures. Now, it can occur to the mind, and does occur to the mind, as it has to mine many times, that something awful must have happened, some mistake must have occurred. But this is not the truth. If you use the analogy of climbing a mountain, as long as you are climbing uphill, it feels difficult. You are struggling for air. Your legs become so tired. You want to turn around and go back down the hill. If you make it only so far up the side of the mountain and decide to go downhill, when you turn around and go down, immediately the feeling is relief. It is a sense of pleasure and release. Now, if the soul is interpreting this as having made the right decision, life is easier when I do this. There's a release of the pressure that I was feeling before. This must be the right decision. But if your goal is to reach the top of the mountain, you are going in 180 degree, the opposite direction that will take you to your goal. So much of sadhana is building our capacity to hold these tensions within our being. Ramakrishna, during his great years of sadhana, said that the tension that he experienced in those times were greater than any other individual could have taken. And his sadhana was tremendous. It is similar to Mother's own sadhana, and the tensions and the opposing forces that were contained within our own being. Now, in both of these great souls' experiences, they knew that their experiences would be more profound, would be more deep, because they were not just doing it for themselves, they were doing it for those who would come after them. There are those souls that take on the greater consciousness of the world. And so their crucifixion is not their own, but rather it is the world's, and they help the world to evolve in this way. So these experiences that they have along the way represent something much greater than what we as individuals would experience on our own way. So we need not look upon their sadhana with horror or turn away, because we don't think that we would be able to make it. We wouldn't have the strength. Each one of us does have the strength. Each one of us have the capacity for making our own ascent in the mountain of consciousness. We are given sufficient grace for whatever we have to go through. And if we think that there are some difficulties along the way in our spiritual path, they compare not at all with the difficulties of continuing on in ignorance and the price that we have to pay for living in that ignorance. And still, we have to find that we go along that narrow razor's edge to the ultimate goal of the mountain peak at some later time. So there is no escaping it. Now, is there some cruel, vindictive God that has set us into this prison and tortured us without end? And the reality is that God is the individual, God within your form, God within my form, had a desire to have this experience, had a desire to come into this material, earthly realm. Now, in times of hardship, we may not remember having that desire, and we may even curse the God that we perceive as putting us here. Nevertheless, it doesn't alleviate us of the individual responsibility that we did have that desire. The proof is that we are here, and that we are the result of our own desire nature, God in this human form, that has taken on this form for a great purpose. It is when we see this world as random acts of cruelty, as having no purpose, that the soul becomes truly depressed. When, through a divine vision, such as Papa had, we see that this world is filled with divine purpose. As Jesus said, there is no hair upon your head that is not counted by God, that a sparrow, a smallest of bird, would not fall from the sky without God's will. And as in the Vedas it says, not a leaf moves without the will of God. Can you imagine that? Not a leaf moves. Not a needle on a great tree has a life without the individual will of God making it so. Every aspect of your life is a result of divine will operating. You are that. But if you are in ignorance of that, then you feel alone, you feel isolated, you feel that the world is out of control, and that these great events that are operating around us are something to be feared, are something to be turned away from. When you live in faith, you know that it is God who is operating all, knowing all, is all. And when you come into a state of realization, you pass from that faith into absolute knowledge. In these experiences that I've had over this past time, concerning these current tensions within the world. Just as you experience your own body, and if you put your attention on your right hand, you know that your right hand is there, where before perhaps you were unconscious of it. If you were to move your left toe, suddenly you become aware of your left toe, where perhaps before you were unaware of it. Even so, in the consciousness that God has given me, I feel as if this world is an extension, is my own body. I feel the tensions grinding and clashing together within this body of consciousness, even as the continents move over the ocean floor and crushing the ocean floor underneath it. And sometimes the pressure and the clashing going on in that subterranean level results in volcanoes coming out and explosions, noxious gases pouring forth, hot lava rock flying into the air. All of this happens in nature, and it is the archetype of this world. And so within this body, I've felt those grinding forces, the tremendous weight, the clashing of those opposing forces. It is the working out of divine will, whether you recognize it or not. That is the truth of it. And it is through those grinding of those forces that the refinement is happening for these souls that are currently engaged in these clashes. One of the things that God showed me, one of the purposes for the Kali Yuga, this relatively short period of time of darkness that we have passed through, it acts as a twilight period in which souls may move from animal and lower consciousness into human consciousness. And so humanity becomes this great mixture of those who are operating largely through instinct. Mankind also has representatives coming down from the last golden age and the Treta Yuga, as well as the Dwapara Yuga and its descending force. And those souls represent the conscious realization that has been gained through those great yugas. And so upon this earth you can find such great contradictions. You can find the kind of soul that Gandhi was and that Hitler was coexisting on the earth at the same time. It seems fantastic that there should be such diverse clashing kind of forces going on, and yet that is the world that we find ourselves in. It not only happens outside of us, but it happens within us as well. If we are to help this world to evolve, if we are to bring light into this world, the most powerful, the most dramatic way we can do it is by first establishing ourselves in union with God. It is not until we have that union with God that we will know what to do. Until then, our actions are based upon ego. And the ego, by its very nature, has limited perspective. But the soul, in its pure form from God, has an unlimited vision. It has a purity of its own divinity manifesting within itself. And that purity guides the knowledge, the words, and the actions of the individual soul. It is from this lofty consciousness that the purity of God consciousness can be brought to bear upon the worldly events. You are an actor upon this world stage We all are. We cannot help it. As long as we draw a breath, as long as we eat food, as long as we are involved in any activity, even the flutter of an eyelash, we are acting in this world. Most of us yearn for the peace, for the calm, for the union of divine consciousness. What we really miss is being able to enter into that divine union within ourselves, consciously, at will. We must focus our attention upon finding that divine union within ourselves. That should be our first goal within our lives. Now, we do have to act, and until we achieve that union, we have to act under the best possible intelligence that we can gain until that point. There was a story told by a disciple of Master. When Master asked him to give talks, and he says, Master told him, turn your whole self over to God. Let him speak through you. Well, he got up before this group of people, this minister of Master's, and as he looked out over everyone, he waited for God to speak through him. Minutes passed by, and God hadn't showed up yet. And so he got nervous, and he reasoned inside of himself, well, if God doesn't do it, then I must do it according to my best intelligence, my best reason. And so he started to speak from his own sense of ego, because he was anxious about what other people might think if he wasn't saying anything up there. We had a similar experience with a disciple of Mother's that Mother asked to give a talk one time. And this man stood up before everybody and was very quiet through most of the time that he was to give a talk. He said a few words here and there. Many people reported that they felt tremendous power of God pouring forth during that time. What would have been humanly an embarrassing situation and may have looked like a total failure, to some who were listening was an incredibly powerful experience. Many of the saints, many of the sages, such as Ramana Maharshi and Meher Baba, spoke very little or not at all. There is a powerful vibration that goes out from the one who has that God consciousness. Each one who remains in that God consciousness expresses themselves in a unique way. And so there is no absolute way that one should act or one should speak. There is no uniform character about those realized souls. Even as we look at the lineage of our own gurus, we see that their personalities are quite strikingly different. It is really wonderful in the sense that it makes you know that it's not by adopting a certain outward personality, it's not by speaking in a certain accent or being born in any particular country that you gain your realization. When we associate great souls with a particular country or a region or a language or an expression of any kind, we limit the expression of God. God has come in your form to express himself in your own uniqueness. Now, we should not let that be an excuse for being something less than that pure light within us will most greatly manifest itself. We should all try to measure up to the very highest light that is within us and not succumb to lower levels of vibration and use that as an excuse that that is God operating through us. That would not be the truth. But God expresses himself through you in totally unique ways. You don't have to become like somebody else. Only when it comes to realized souls, we become like them in the sense of this. We become fully realized in our consciousness of our oneness with God, with our oneness with that great spiritual consciousness that is residing deep within our souls. We become in conscious union with that, and every expression of our lives becomes an expression of that ultimate divine consciousness. Truly, both within and without, is the clashing and the grinding of these oppositional forces. But we should not be afraid. We need not look with horror, although there may be horrible things that happen, both within and without. But we should take our cue from Krishna, who looks out upon this opposing play and sees it all as the play of consciousness. This does not mean that we become hard-hearted towards those who are suffering. In fact, if anything, we become more softened towards those who are in pain, towards those who are having such great difficulty, because we cannot unhook our consciousness from them. We know that they are intimately connected with us and we with them. But we see it with that universal light of vision. We see this world and its clashing from the true perspective, that this is God working out his life, his consciousness. It is his threshing floor. It is his grinding stone by which raw souls that are not yet ready to be made part of God's great feast are undergoing that preparation. It is by these forces coming together that the evolution occurs. Every soul comes with its own desires. Many souls think that it can create the perfection here on earth. Jesus warns us when he says, "You will have the poor with you always," that there is some inherent aspect of duality in this world that we will never see absolute perfection upon this earth. And so for us to look for it with the exclusion of not finding it first within ourselves will always leave us short of the goal. We will always find the world lacking in that perfection. We see different souls who get so upset about this world, and truly, there are some things to get upset about. But they lose their balance. They lose their perspective because they lose the universal vision when they encounter things of this world. There should be nothing within this world that distracts us from first looking for and then finding that universal vision. That is the bhakti that Papa speaks of, is that tremendous search for truth, for that universal vision, that love for God. And that's the power that takes us up the spiritual ladder. Once we have arrived at the top of the ladder, we enter and merge into our oneness with that divine spirit that is formless, beginningless, and endless. And there we find our union with that perfection of God that we have so yearned for, that we have so longed for. Then, if God wills, as our will, the divine will within us, we descend back down through the ladder, but we bring that universal vision with us. The Ani will see that that highest peak of experience is reality, and perceive this world as an illusion. But the Parabhakti, as Papa refers to him, is that one who comes back down the ladder of consciousness, and they see this world in perfection, just as much as that unified, formless, static aspect of God is also perfection. There is perfection within, there is perfection without. There is perfection above and below. Indeed, there is nothing that is not a perfect expression of that unity, of that love, of that light of God. Even in the seeming shadows and darkness of this world, perfection reigns. Through and through, the unified yogi feels himself in full force, one with the infinite spirit. This is, so to speak, the end of our quest. And yet, in a very real sense, we, for the first time, really live, because we are living in that divine union, that divine consciousness. This is the real purpose for which we have come. So, as I say, while we may be keenly aware of world events, more aware of that divine unity existing within us. And as Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these other things shall be added unto you. Seek ye first within your own soul that divine perfection. Then that divine perfection will express itself effortlessly through your words, your thoughts, through your actions. Seek ye first God and His kingdom. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my body. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet. And surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Peace. Bliss. Amen.